Evening. My name is Walter Armus, fellow of the Middle East Center, and it's my pleasure to chair this evening's seminar. Tonight's lecture focuses on Syria, which, as we all know, has ceased being ruled by the Assad family since early December of last year. The fall of Bashar al-Assad was met with joy by millions of Syrians, but of course the future of Syria is by no means completely clear. Whether or not Ahmed al-Sharaa will have the support necessary to unite Syria and begin reconstructing it is not assured, although there's reason to be hopeful. The problems faced by Syria are formidable, ranging from reconciliation after a long civil war to dealing with the many outside powers that have been involved in Syrian affairs for decades. To shed some light on how Syria got to this point, and presumably how its recent past will affect its future trajectory, we have Professor Johannes Wartenberg from the Free University of Languages and Communications in Milan. I won't try to pronounce it in Italian, but you can tell us if you like.
L'Istituto Universitario Libero di Milano.
Thank you. Professor Wartenberg has been teaching the general history of the Arab world at the University in Milan. As a historian, he specializes in the period of the Ba'ath Party in power in the 20th century, in 20th century Syria. He's presently lecturing in West European countries on the historical roots of the Assad regime. In his widely acclaimed study, La Siria Contemporanea Ridisegnando la Carta del Regime Oriente, in English, it's the Contemporary Syria Redrawing the Map of the Near East, which came out in two volumes in 2021 in Rome with the Nellino Institute. And he describes in this work the transformations of the state economy in Syria and the diverse international backing of the Assad family over the years. He's now finishing a publication on the implications of the Swiss government's involvement in the United Nations Commission for Human Rights Violations in Syria. The title of his lecture is The Chaos, Fauda, Bashar al-Assad Warned Against, Damascus University, 10th November 2005, and present-day Syria. Please join me in welcoming Professor Johannes Wartenberg.
Good evening. Well, thank you very much for all of you here tonight. Thank you, Professor Armus, for your introduction. Thanks to Professor Eugene Rogan, who can't be here tonight, but who made this initiative possible. And of course, thanks so much to Jenny for all the work she does that is essential to any scholarly initiative. So, well, we'll talk about Syria tonight, which is obviously under the title. We'll talk about Fauda, so chaos, and we'll try to bring into the picture and our understanding some elements of history, which is not something normally happens. When one talks about the unfolding of events in one of the countries of the Middle East, often it's more a question of recent events, political analysis, social transformation, social actors, but historians are not often called into the discussion to try to bring elements of deeper understanding. Now, I'll try to give two simple examples of obviously a lack of historical background to opinion makers, to the pieces they write. This is an article which was published in Le Courrier, which is a newspaper in Switzerland. So it's the 10th of December 2024, just after the fall of Bashar al-Assad, which happened on the 8th of December. You can see just in the final part of the article, the author. So it's Abdel Bakawan, who says that sans l'appui de la famille al-Assad, le Hezbollah n'aurait pas vu le jour. So I'm reading this part. Obviously, he tries to make us think that it's Al-Assad who created Hezbollah. That's obviously not the case. For anyone knowing the history of Lebanon, the invasion of 82, I mean, it was not the Al-Assad family which put up Hezbollah. Hezbollah has a completely different history. But this is an example of a specialist, is a French specialist on the region, on Iraq, brings into the picture historical elements or information which are just not correct. So that's the first example to the of the importance to have a check find fact checking of the historical information one introduces. And the other example I wanted to mention just in the introduction is that a lot has been said, of course, about the fall of Bashar al-Assad and his regime, but one element which is strangely not mentioned at all is the interview Ehud Barak, who was then back then Minister of Defense of Israel, gave to CNN on the 16th of May 2012, in which he basically suggested that one could get rid of the Assad regime and with the help of the Turks, and that this would weaken the Iranians. So basically what we've seen playing out in between November and December reflects a strategy of one of, an important Israeli political actor of that period. And that is absolutely not referred to in the present debates, discussions. I mean, when one looks at the events in Syria as if it comes out of nowhere, without having the background and the understanding of how these changes might have been planned to a certain extent. Talking about the Israelis on the subject of Syria, I just want to point out that there was an acknowledgement by Biden on the 8th of December, so when just the same day basically as Damascus was liberated from Assad, that so Biden makes a press or let's say public speech where he talks about the fact of managing the risk of new Syria. So he takes responsibility for what has just occurred in Syria. And one knows that a lot of the American apparatus that worked under Biden had connections, of course, with the Israeli establishment, and there were really most probably connections around these events between certain sectors of the Israeli defense sector and the Americans. Now, one other school of thought on the side of the Israelis is what one can refer to as maybe as the school of Avigdor Lieberman, who makes a speech on the 3rd of October 2017, where he says that Assad has won, and that all the Arab countries need to reconnect with Assad. I mean, to normalize relationships with Assad. And this strangely happens just less than a month after a speech by Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah on the 12th of September 2017, where he says, he has the same speech. He says, we've won the war. This was just basically in the campaign for reconquering the Deir ez-Zor governorate. So Nasrallah makes a speech saying, we've won. A couple of weeks later, Lieberman says, Assad has won, the Arab countries should normalize their relationships. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is because one has to think always, when looking at the events in the region, what an actor like Israel does. I mean, it's not the only important actor, but it's a crucial actor. And in the case of Syria, there are obviously different trends. And unfortunately, this kind of information is not widely circulated when the specialists are invited to talk about the fall of the regime. Another interesting element of the speech of Nasrallah of September 2017 is that he basically says or announced that his troops would go retreat from Syria. So that happened, 7 years before the latest events in Lebanon. So the whole understanding that because of the difficulties of Hezbollah in Lebanon, Syria was an easy target is obviously also questionable. I mean, if Hezbollah withdrew its forces in 2017, then probably, and that's basically what we saw on the ground, the regime was not supported anymore militarily by Hezbollah as it had been in the previous years. I mean, there is a lot of discussion about why Assad fell after the war on Hezbollah. We'll perhaps get into that later on with the questions or with the further discussion. The main understanding is that it was some kind of checklist on the part of the Israelis or the Americans to say, well, listen, there is this axis of resistance. We want to defeat Iran. Let's pick the one after the other. My understanding is somehow different. I was on the ground in Lebanon from September to December, so I witnessed the events there. And obviously what I saw is that it's a difficulty on the part of the Israelis. I mean, I wasn't in the south myself, but I really saw the difficulty of the Israelis to get a handhold on the country. So I mean, my understanding is it's because of the difficulties of the Israelis in the south of Lebanon that the option of removing al-Assad came into the picture. I mean, we'll perhaps discuss more about how that really happened, but I think that it wasn't originally planned that some kind of international alliance or group of actors would go this far. Now, why am I saying going this far? I mean, removing Bashar al-Assad or Assad family from the region and from Syria is a gigantic transformation. I mean, it's nothing less than that. I mean, they go back to the 70s, 1970. They came to power in November 1970. In fact, there was an internal strife inside the Ba'ath Party and the Alawite faction of the Ba'ath Party in February 69. So the real moment in which Hafez al-Assad signals his power in the country is February 69. So you've got a dynasty which starts in 69 and comes, I mean, until 2024, which is an incredible arc of time, and with huge events happening in the region. I won't go through all of that, of course, now, but it's just to exemplify or to illustrate how much this transformation means for the region. And the Assad family is already known as having its history. You know, I mean, we all have some understanding of Syria and of its past. They didn't have a good reputation, you know, the al-Assads. I mean, we think of Tel al-Zatar in Lebanon. We can think of, Yarmouk, more recently, the Palestinian camp in Damascus, but also the massacre of Hama in 82. I mean, this family had blood on his hands. There is no doubt about that. So how did they manage, you know, to keep in power for so long? Other dictators or other families of I don't know if there are any other families around in point of way, but had left the power soon is probably the best word, but I mean rapidly, whereas the al-Assad remained in power for 5 decades, and that's why I thought that it might be interesting for all of us to have a look at this famous speech of Jamia Dimashq of 2005 in the Damascus University speech of Bashar al-Assad, because I think in his in the words of a dictator and the words of this, I mean, his own words, one can understand a lot of what is really happening behind the scenes. So many of the different state actors in the region have a presentation of what they're up to their people, to international audience, but the whole region being split up the way it is has to coordinate. I mean, the different actors have to coordinate, and I think this speech is a unique illustration of how this works, basically. I'll just give an element of understanding also of this coordination between different actors by mentioning the extent to which after 2000 and I would say 2015, so from 2015 onwards, different international actors, the Russians, Americans, the Turkish state, the Israelis, the Hezbollah, of course. I mean, different actors organized their territorial influence or occupation of Syria. So, I mean, looking at that period of time from 2015 onwards, one sees how on the ground, all these different, you know, international actors, regional actors, make an arrangement, okay? And the speech we're going to look at, or listen at least, a short passage, gives us the keys to understanding how an actor like al-Assad refers to those agreements. We'll move to the video, if that's okay. So originally, the text used to be rewritten. I mean, it was available on the internet. There was an official page, President Bashar al-Assad, so you could, you know, check on all his speeches and stuff. That page doesn't exist anymore, for obvious reasons, but we still can find the tape of the speech. And, so I'll just show a start, a moment of the beginning, just to give the atmosphere of what it was like back then. I've never seen such a context in a speech in a university. I mean, I've been to quite some universities. It's quite unique. And then we'll focus on a real passage of the text.
قبل أن أبدأ الكلمة سئلت كثيرا خلال الأسبوع الماضي بنوع من القلق، لماذا أنت شاحب؟ بسبب الضغوط؟ قلت لا، لأنني كنت مصاب بوحدة صحية، فلكي لا نسأل هذا السؤال مرة أخرى، الضغوط السياسية لا
Okay, so he's reassuring everyone, he's not sick, he's all right, he will deliver his speech.
سيكون هناك مقارنة بين أي التزام على في هذا العالم والالتزام الوطني، فالالتزام الوطني هو أولا لأننا لسنا سواح في هذه المنطقة ولسنا زوار، نحن الأهل أهل هذه المنطقة، نعيش هنا ونحن
The passage we will analyze is just after this.
أما الشرعية الدولية ولم ندعم الفوضى الدولية. الشرعية الدولية هي ميثاق الأمم المتحدة. أما الفوضى الدولية فهي ارتكاز القرارات على بعض المصالح وبعض المزاج لبعض المسؤولين في هذا العالم. وعلى هذه الدول وعلى هذه القوى وعلى كل إنسان في هذه المنطقة وفي العالم أن يعرف بأن عصر المصايب الذي كان موجودا في بدايات القرن الماضي قد انتهى، والآن المنطقة أو المنطقة أمام خيارين لا ثالث لهما، إما المقاومة والصمود أو الفوضى، لا يوجد خيار آخر، والمقاومة هي التي تمنع الفوضى، والمقاومة لها ثمن والفوضى لها ثمن، لكن ثمن المقاومة والصمود أقل بكثير من ثمن الفوضى، يجب أن نعرف بدقة. أما الابتزاز، إذا كانوا يعتقدون بأنه بهذه الطريقة يحاول ابتزاز سوريا، فنقول لهم بأن العنوان خاطئ. أما إذا كان
أما
يطرحون مشكلة من هنا لكي يساومونا على أشياء مختلفة تخص أشياء أخرى كما كالعراق على سبيل المثال، فليتفضلوا وليساوموا وليفاضلونا فوق الطاولة أمام شعبنا. لا يوجد لدينا شيء كي نخجل منه. علاقة صراحة بيننا وبين الشعب ما يطرح. ولكن تقول هذا الشيء للمسؤولين الأمريكيين في السابق، إذا كان لديكم صفقة وأنتم تحبون الصفقات تفضلوا وطرحوا هذه الصفقة علي وأنا سأعرضها على الشعب. يوافق الشعب لا توجد لدينا مشكلة.
Okay. We'll get into the translation. So I'll just read it out because I realize we can't, I mean, it's not easy to see it over there. So we've supported international legitimacy and have not supported international disorder. International legitimacy is the United Nations Charter, where international disorder is basing resolutions on the interests and moods of certain decision makers. I don't know if you can hear me. Decision makers in this world, those countries, those forces, and everybody in this region and in the world should know that the era of tutelage, which existed at the beginning of the last century, is over, and now the region is faced with two choices: either resistance and steadfastness or chaos. There is no third choice. Resistance prevents chaos. Resistance has a price and chaos has a price. But the price of resistance is much less than the price of chaos. We need to know these things about blackmail. If they believe that in this way they can try to blackmail Syria, we tell them that they are at the wrong address. But if the matter is one of bargaining with them, raising a problem here to bargain with us about different things concerning other matters, for instance Iraq, then they're welcome to come and negotiate with us around the table in front of the people. So what we have here is basically the choice given to the international community: or you keep us and the resistance that is also, I mean, Hezbollah, or you face something terrible, you know, it's chaos. And it's basically, I mean, he's talking to the university audience. I mean, I didn't really see a lot of students up there, but anyway, it was the university. I mean, people inside the university. They were not, you know, the public he was talking to. The public he was talking to was the international community. He mentions the region, he talks about the events in Iraq. I mean, 2005 is just before the unleashing of really sectarian violence in Iraq. That started in 2006, mainly. It's a moment of truth for everyone. Just to put the context of this speech, so as we'll all remember, the assassination of Rafik Hariri, so the Prime Minister of Lebanon, happened on the 14th of February 2005, so the same year, but at the start of the year. And up until March, April 2005, the Syrians were present in Lebanon. You know, they were the occupying force in Lebanon, they were looking after Lebanon, and as they would say it themselves. And this was under the umbrella of an international agreement. It wasn't written that way in the Taif agreements, but the Taif agreements were used by Syria to legitimize them staying in the country. They had invaded Lebanon in 1976 and repressed the Palestinian movement. I mean, they were called in by the Maronites, conservative factions to help and save the Lebanese state in 1976, and that's what they did basically. So they've been there a long period. In February, Prime Minister Hariri gets killed. Everyone believes it's the Syrians who did that, and you have mass protests in Beirut. Population is really fed up with this occupation by the Syrians, and they withdraw. They withdraw extremely quickly. I mean, knowing the Syrian regime, I mean, the fact that they withdrew in less than 2 months is quite unbelievable. So one of the chapters of my book is trying to think about these events of Lebanon at the beginning of 2005 with different elements. And not only the official idea that Syria or Hezbollah are the only ones who create havoc in Lebanon. Now, the other element which is important is that an international commission, international investigation, independent commission was put up by the United Nations to investigate on the killing of Hariri, and they had come out with first reports on the 20th of October. So that's 20 days before this speech. And on the 20th of October 2005, this report says, well, probably, you know, Syrians killed Hariri. So this speech is also a rebuke against an international accusation that, you know, they were Syria is responsible for the murder of Hariri. Assad is under pressure when he makes his speech. There is a new spring, movement which came up in Damascus, the spring of 2005-2006. So he really needs to state his position to make clear to the people, to the international actors, we've got a deal. There is a deal between the Al-Assad family and the international community. Don't forget that. If you get rid of us, you've got chaos. If we stay in power, it has a cost. We know that. I mean, we're not there for free, you know? There is a cost to us staying in power. But don't forget, there is a deal between us. And this deal goes back to the 60s, okay? To the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. Now, one good illustration of what this deal is really all about is what Michael Hayden, who was ex-director of the CIA, said in Congress on the 12th of December 2013. So, 8 years after this speech. And he basically said, I mean, the uprising has started in Syria. I mean, there are masses of events, chemical attacks happened. And he basically says, let's keep the Al-Assad, you know, because they're going to guarantee the regional order. And what he means by that is that if you get rid of the Al-Assad, you know, all the setup of the region, which goes back decades, is at risk. Including Israel. He says it very clearly in his speech to Congress. He says even Israel is at risk if Al-Assad is removed. This position that the Syrian regime, or this Syrian regime, was useful for a regional setup in favor of international order was already very clear to the French. I mean, back in the 80s, they would do, I mean, they've got, of course, quite some links to Syria and to Lebanon, but they would say back then, the Assad are a guarantor of stability for the region. Let's not forget that this whole argument that the Assads play a positive role in the way the region is run has been used also extensively when the Islamist militant factions were on the news quite systematically from 2014 onwards. So Assad used to say, well, I'm going to stand with the minorities, I'm going to stand with the Christians, so the risk would be that Islamists take over, etc., etc. So this idea that Al-Assad plays a positive role in the region has been re-evoked quite recently, the last decade. I mean, one can compare to a certain extent the role which has been attributed to Al-Assad back in the 70s, I mean, the whole region was in transformation, in radical transformation. The Soviets, of course, plays a huge role back then. Yeah, I mean, one of the comparisons one can make is with the Palestinian Authority. I mean, where the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has responsibility of doing the policing, you know, for Israel, and that's what their task is, okay? And you can imagine a role attributed to Al-Assad in the same manner by, of course, a different constellation of actors, but for a broader, well, a country like Syria, but also a broader, the broader region. Okay, so I'll just move on with a couple of pictures. This was an article which came out in 23, so it was just before the reintroduction of al-Assad in the Arab League, which happened in August 23. He has a visit by the Saudi ambassador to Jordan. Things are getting back on track. Okay, so I mean, all this event of the uprising and whatever has happened, the massacres, Sidnaya, whatever, you know, it's all forgotten. Let's get back to business as usual. And you even have Le Monde, so the French newspaper, which publishes September 24. I mean, the year is left out of the scan, but it's September 24. Basically, the war is over. The newspaper talks about the role women play. I mean, this is an article about Aleppo. But I mean, up until November 2024, the business was, you know, it was settled. Assad had won the war. You would get back to what agreements were previously with actors of the region, as if nothing had happened. I mean, he had got away with the massacre of Hama 82. I mean, his father had got away with the massacre of Hama 82. So Bashar al-Assad thought, well, I mean, it took me a bit longer, you know, but this is how it works. It didn't work that way, you know. It's changed. Something changed. I mean, between the agreement, which is clearly announced in 2005, which allows Bashar al-Assad to be reintroduced first in France to the parade of the 14th of July 2008, where he stands next to Sarkozy. Bashar al-Assad, after his speech, will really, you know a new experience, a new blossom of international influence, at least up until 2011. The case of 2023 and 2024, where he's reintroduced in the Arab League, and an important European actor as the Italian state, through the government of Giorgia Meloni, really tries to open up again for Bashar al-Assad the whole international community. It just doesn't work. I mean, there is something in the combination which is broken. Now, one of the essential questions, of course, is why are we not afraid, why is the international community, why are regional and international and world actors not anymore afraid of the Fawda? So this region in which the Assad would not be the policeman of regional order, okay? Why are we not afraid of that anymore? And I've tried to imagine some elements, you know? But there is no definitive answer to that question. Because even Biden, when he claims, I mean, his role in the fall of Bashar al-Assad on the 8th of December, in his public speech, he mentions that there is a risk. So they've taken this initiative to get rid of al-Assad, but there is a risk to that. The elements I've written down, but I mean, well, we can discuss that, of course, is, first of all, Syria, although it was reintroduced to the international and to the regional scene, was not able to function efficiently as a regional policeman anymore. I mean, they would continue to repress the local population, but their influence inside the Palestinian movement was not relevant, etc., etc., etc. So, I mean, they weren't able to guarantee the setup was going to remain. That's one element. Another element, of course, it's a way in which they played into radical Islamism. So, I mean, they instigated the creation of Daesh. They played a huge role in the development of Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the years 2000. And I mean, the international community had to get involved, you know, to deal with that. So that was, of course, not a very good point on the CV of Bashar al-Assad. There is a question of the forever war of Israel, that Israel believes it doesn't need the al-Assad in Syria anymore. I mean, it can bomb anywhere, whenever it wants.
So why have these people there in power? I mean, you know, the new generation of Israeli leaders just thinks differently. And there is, as I said at the start, there is a distinction to be made in the Israeli elite or political class. People believe in some way. I mean, there are different approaches. But obviously, what happened after the 7th of October 2023 has unleashed a level of violence which the region has not really experienced before on the part of the Israelis. And, well, in that case, I mean, if you've got a tsunami going through the region, perhaps a powerhouse like the Al-Assad is not necessary anymore. I mean, that's one point. One other element which I think needs to be considered is that Biden was, so he claims his role in these events, was afraid of Trump, of what Trump would do. Because let's not forget that when we had the first presidency of Donald Trump, he went nearly to North Korea. So what would be, you know, the scenario of Trump going to the mosque and shaking hands with Bashar al-Assad? I mean, that's not really what the traditional, at least Democrat, establishment in the United States is looking for. And one element I do think is important, and I mentioned that earlier, is this idea that Israel did not win in Lebanon. I mean, I know this is not the mainstream analysis of events, but Israel, to my understanding, did not win in Lebanon. They didn't manage to get a foothold in the country. I mean, they went some kilometers inside the country, but I mean, for anyone who knows the history of Israeli invasions in Lebanon, I mean, this is peanuts. I mean, not the level of destruction. The level of destruction is immense. You know, in the south, in Dahir, in the southern suburbs of Beirut, also elsewhere in the Beqa, but the foothold on the ground is really not significant. And there were different battles, the Israelis could just not move forward. So my understanding is that they face real military difficulties on the ground, that Hezbollah has not been massively downgraded militarily, and therefore something else needed to be done in the region to have a change of contest with Iran. And the easiest element which could be taken out of the equation was Bashar al-Assad. However, Bashar al-Assad was also part of a wider game, as I've said. So taking out Bashar al-Assad, as Biden says it himself, has some risk to it too. So the fall of Assad is also getting rid of someone, or at least with a dynasty that has worked together with Western interests. I mean, the European Union was involved in Syria massively. I mean, this idea that Iran has been defeated and that you know, everything is going for the better on the side of the Israelis, I don't agree with that opinion. I don't think. What I'll try, well, if I've just got 10 minutes? Yeah? Okay. What I'll do for the last, well, I don't know if even it's going to take 10 minutes, but I'll just try to show how I come to these different kind of conclusions, which are, well, what I try to do is bring philosophy into history. That is, you have the events, you have historical, transformation, but you try to understand what is the underlying dynamic, what are the underlying dynamics, and if there is any coherence to the succession of events. And so my work is not only to describe what, you know, happens in a country from 81 to 86 and go through, but I try to distinguish why things happen and what might happen in the future if one manages to distinguish trends. I mean, I had quite a tough discussion on this approach with the colleagues in the OIB in Beirut in June last year, where they really didn't go along with this idea that you connect events in history and try to distinguish trends. I mean, history should also only be about describing, you know,
perception or singular moments in history, okay? Whereas what I try to do is, but I'm not the only one, of course, but is to indicate the roots of transformation, and if those dynamics continue, they probably lead to transformation in the future. And also, with state actors involved, they act really following patterns. Whatever the politicians are, I mean, whoever the politicians are, whoever is in power, states function like patterns. I mean, with patterns, excuse me. And one good example of that is France in connection to Lebanon. I mean, the French, they always go back to the Lebanese, they always try to re-evocate their role in Lebanon. So, I mean, even if the politicians change, these underlying trends of involvement by countries or states continue. I'll just show you this piece of work, which, as Jenny said, it looks like a work of art, but it isn't. What I've tried to do here, and I'll pass this on, I mean, this is basically the way I work on these kind of events, and try to find coherence among all the things that happen. I mean, I'm sorry, the projection is quite bad, so I know that. There is a printed copy which is going to go around, so I mean, even if I finish and, you know, questions get going, you can still look at the printed copy. So what I've done here is that I've tried to identify the main events. So this line you've got in the middle are the main events happening between March 2011 and autumn 2018 in Syria. Okay, so these are basically the events with the dates. I mean, I've signaled only the dates, but what really was, to my understanding, the most relevant of what was happening. Now, all the dots you can see above, you know, or underneath, have different colors. Again, I apologize because it's not easy to see it from where you're sitting, but there are 14 different colors, 14 different actors. So I've distinguished United States, the EU, the European Union, Turkey, Iran, NATO. I mean, I've made a list of actors that, to my understanding, are playing a role in Syria back then. We're playing a role. And if you have a dot which corresponds to a date and a country, that means, and it's in the upper part, then it means that it's taken an initiative. Okay? So, for example, if Erdogan, invites rebel factions to constitute the Free Syrian Army in Istanbul, it would be up here, okay? Now, under here, you would have the same list of actors with events if they have the consequences of actions of others. So the results of the others' actions on them, okay? I don't know if that's clear enough, but the interesting thing is that you notice from the start of the events, you know, as they move on, is that you have more and more of the countries which are in the lower part of the map, okay? This part. I mean, the amount of countries in the lower part grow. That means that you have more and more people who are watching what happens in Syria, okay? I mean, countries, that's what I mean. And of course, at the start, you don't see a lot of international actors involved. And that's exactly what the Syrians experienced. That you had that they were basically abandoned for months to what the Assads wanted to do. One point which is interesting, I think, is that this line, which is up here, but again, which is a bit difficult to see, is United States. Now, one actor which is rarely mentioned as having constantly worked on Syria is the United States.
I mean, one talks about Iran, one talks about Russia, Hezbollah, etc., etc. Of course, I mean, Israel is always also in the picture, but I mean, America has, I mean, the United States, they've played a huge role. I mean, they were all everything. They were just following all the file. They had all their different agencies implicated in the whole thing, up until November. I mean, even with the fall of Assad. So you can really see through some detail like this that the policy of the United States as a state actor. You know, I'm not talking about the single individual or the single politician, but as a state actor, to maintain an actor or a regime like the Assad regime in Syria is illustrated in the amount of work they put into it, you know? And of course, when, for example, when the Russians got involved in September 2015, then the Americans had to adapt to that. So they put up the Syrian Democratic Forces. So the base of Al-Tanf, which is on the motorway between Damascus and Baghdad, was put up. So, I mean, the Americans, they're not completely, how would you say that? They're not passive. They take initiative on the ground too. But up until November 2024, in a really, really measured manner. Well, thank you very much.
So thank you for that immensely well-informed lecture. I was intrigued particularly with the American part of it, which you kind of emphasized near the end. The premise of your lecture was I guess, I mean, Assad saying from the beginning, either you have me or you have chaos.
Yeah.
But arguably Syria got both over the almost a decade and a half. We got both the chaos and still Bashar al-Assad. And you're suggesting that the United States was basically working to maintain that situation. Did I understand that correctly?
Exactly.
So my question is, what happens now? I mean, when we were talking earlier, you were saying that the biggest wild card was Israel, that you could kind of predict the interests of most of the other foreign powers that were involved in Syria, but that Israel was less predictable. I mean, the either me or chaos is a kind of transactional logic, and now you've got America ruled by somebody who's like the champion of transactional politics. And so I'm wondering, I mean, what's going to happen now that we've got an American regime that is intensely transactional? I mean, are they now going to turn around and say they want something different from Syria? I mean, what can you speculate on what that might be?
You mean the Trump administration?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier that Biden was afraid what Trump would do, that he would go in and start talking to Assad directly, I guess.
But that's a hypothesis on my part. I mean, I don't have hard proof of that, but I think that's that played a role.
But of course, now the situation is much more fluid.
I think Trump is he's not unhappy with the situation he inherited, and I didn't have any trace of him saying he wanted Assad back.
But maybe he'll want something else. He'll want, you know, a Riviera in Syria as well as in Gaza.
Well, I think, I mean, Biden, when he left, he introduced the Saudis to the file. So there was a real idea that Saudi Arabia should play an important role in the future of Syria. I mean, I think that Saudi Arabia is also very surprised by what happened. Qatar was on board. I mean, they played an immense role in encouraging or supporting the takeover. But if Saudi Arabia is involved and Trump has some kind of connection with Saudi Arabia, as we've seen, you know, I mean, their Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of the United States Foreign Affairs and the Russian counterpart have met in Riyadh, or it was in Riyadh, yeah, I mean, in Saudi Arabia anyway. So I think that will appease Trump.
And I think he's really busy with other subjects in the region. I mean, Palestine being one, and it's not only Gaza, of course, and Lebanon is another one. I think he mustn't be, but I mean, I could be mistaken, but thinking too much about Syria. And the impression I get from the ground there is that the Syrians themselves have not yet understood who is really going to take an initiative. I mean, there have been demands repeatedly that the European Union lift the sanctions, for example, on the Syrian state, but there is a lull of decision making. And one interesting dimension, for example, is the information people get, people in Syria, the information they receive, you know. What kind of news do they get? And it's extremely confusing. It's extremely confusing what the country is going to look like, who's going to do what, who's going to be in charge, so there is uncertainty, and I think that must mean that there is no real initiative taken on the part of Trump for the time being.
Please join me in thanking Professor Wardenberg for an excellent presentation.